Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the LGC News Roundup podcast. My name's Martin George, I'm the Deputy Editor. I'm joined today by Megan Kenyon, our Senior Reporter. Hi Megan.
Hi Martin.
And Sarah Kalkin, our Editor. Hi Sarah.
Hello.
So today we're going to be concentrating on three main things. First up, the five-year-old council that has just received a best value notice from ministers amid concerns over finances and governance. The regulation of social care, of course the biggest area of local authorities' spending. And we'll be having a look at life after LEPs, or local enterprise partnerships, including a chat with our special guest, Jonathan Werren of the Localis think tank. Let's start off though, and Megan, this has been your story. The government has issued a best value notice because of concerns at Bournemouth, Poole and Christchurch Council, only formed back in 2018 with the merger of three constituent councils. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, so I've been covering this story for about a year now. It's been rumbling on for a little while. It basically all started with a row over beach huts. So if anyone's been to Bournemouth, you can probably remember the beautiful beach huts along the beachfront. The council last year had a big plan to basically set up what's called a special purpose vehicle, which is a sort of company which it would then sell the beach huts to, and then kind of sell them back to the council, which it plan to raise about £56 million to plug a big hole in its transformation project. Now, its transformation project arose from unitarisation. There were three councils which came together to form Bournemouth, Christchurch and Poole, the unitary, in 2019. Now, a year on from that plan, which was stopped by Greg Clark, the then Levelling Up Secretary, because it was deemed too risky. Lee Rowley, the local government minister at the moment, has issued a best value notice into the council, which is basically saying that it needs to prove to the Department for Levelling Up that it's working on improving in a number of areas, not just finance, both governance as well, that, yeah, it's working to improve, because basically a report completed by former Chief Executive Islington, Leslie Seary, found a series of issues with the council, so kind of linked to unitarisation. One of them was around governance and around councillors feeling more of an allegiance to the former authorities that kind of came together to form BCP. And that's kind of caused a lot of turbulence in terms of member relations and the ability for the council to make decisions. And just, I think one of the things that really stood out to me was that both officers and members in Leslie Seary's report had kind of said that there was a level of toxicity at BCP that they'd not found anywhere, like working anywhere else. And I think kind of that really sums up the fact that it's just not conducive to, yeah, it's not a really a working environment conducive to kind of delivering the services which councils are sort of meant to deliver if members can't even agree on things. So yeah, so this best value notice has been issued both because of that and because of what the report called unorthodox budgetary setting, an unorthodox approach to budget setting.
That really stood out, that detail in Leslie Seary's report, that at one point councillors and officers were actually developing parallel budgets. So I think, yeah, the officers were sort of plugging away, developing a budget, and the administration, the political administration, was coming up with its own ideas, and auditors were concerned that there was going to be some last minute amendments that made the budget unsound. I mean, that's quite staggering. I can't remember hearing of anything like that before.
I think what astonished me was that the whole beach huts thing blew up last summer when the government stepped in and said, "It's bonkers, you cannot do this." And yet, you know, 6 months or so later, there was still this sort of unorthodox financial planning going on among the politicians, at least. Yeah, it's as if they hadn't really woken up to how serious the government's concerns were. And I mean, Megan,
I was going to say, I think it's important to say at this point that the administration of BCP changed at the May elections. So I think when it was the new council was agreed in 2018, came into being in 2019, and originally it had a coalition administration led by the Lib Dems, and then the Conservatives got into power and they were the ones doing the beach hut proposal. And then since May, it's been back to this coalition again with the Lib Dem leader. So just important to be clear about that.
And that was something that the report kind of pointed out, was that in its 5 years of life as a council, BCP's had three leaders, or 4 or 5 years, which is, that's quite a lot of leaders for a very short time. And I think, you know, within that, the former Conservative leader, Drew Mellor, stood down earlier this year and was replaced by his deputy, Philip Broadhead. But I think one of the reasons he stated for his resignation was because he felt he wasn't being allowed to, you know, he was a low tax Conservative, and didn't, you know, the council needed to raise this money, but he didn't want to do that through raising council tax or selling off assets and things like that. He wanted to look to more innovative solutions, but he didn't feel he was being allowed to do that, which I think was a reason for his resignation. So I think, you know, there's all those, it's quite interesting tied up in there. I think the report makes for very good reading. I think it's really interesting in terms of seeing what could sort of go wrong and what to look out for when going through unitarisation.
I think that's the key point, isn't it? Because, I mean, just April this year, we've got four newly formed unitary councils. It's Somerset, North Yorkshire, Cumberland, Westmorland and Furness. And I guess, hopefully, they'll be reading this report to really, you know, look for potential pitfalls and things they've got to really look out for. But I mean, Sarah, isn't the first time we've seen unitarisation having some problems?
Yeah, I think it's been quite common theme in lots of unitarisation processes, where a number of districts and the counties have come together to form a new organisation, and there's often perceptions of one organisation taking over the other, and people, you know, as in BCP, feeling affiliation to the organisation they were originally employed by, and all these kind of things will foster bad relationships. I think one of the sort of most high profile cases was Cheshire East, where that reorganisation was blamed for sort of a legacy of bad governance and poor culture that thankfully now it seems to have moved on from. But certainly it created challenges for a number of years after it came into being in 2009. So, definitely, I'm sure other councils going through this process will be watching on with interest.
As will we, of course. Now, moving on, another big area is obviously social care, and some concerns, Megan, this week about the regulation of social care and different bodies becoming involved in this, possible duplication and one bit of government not talking to another. Talk us through what's quite a complex picture.
Yeah, so I have been doing some work looking into the Office for Local Government, which has been almost a regular guest on this podcast, the amount of times we've mentioned it, but obviously launched last month. As part of that was a new data, Local Authority Data Explorer, which covers four key areas, and one of those is adult social care. Now, I think there was some sort of concern and I don't want to say confusion because I think that's the wrong word, but a lack of clarity over what exactly the role of adult social care is in the Oflog data dashboard, how that fits into the wider regulatory picture and landscape for social care, because at the same time as as this is being sort of outlined, you know, we've got these new metrics whereby both the government and residents can measure a council's performance in social care through the Oflog dashboard. You've also got the Care Quality Commission rolling out a new regulatory framework, which is kind of like Ofsted and schools. It will rate councils' social care performance with a single word. Now, I didn't look in depth at the CQC ratings. I looked at Oflog, but I think there was some sort of concern over how the two would fit together, because basically Oflog is obviously rolling out these new metrics, which when I spoke to people in the sector, it seems as though there was sort of some disappointment that there wasn't enough co-design with local government over what exactly would be used in the new dashboard. So, you know, Abby Brown from the LGA, Innovation and Improvement Board, basically said that there needs to be in future more work done with local government to work out exactly, okay, how do we encompass the really broad breadth of things that adult social care does into this data dashboard, so that when we are measuring performance, we're measuring it to the best of our ability. But I think that concerns from councils that were put forward to the Department for Levelling Up before Oflog launched about what exactly the metrics that are being used weren't then translated when it was launched. So I think there was some concern about that. Particularly, I think one thing that really stood out to me when I was researching this was, so say you live in a two-tier area. So say you live in Tunbridge Wells. Obviously, Tunbridge Wells Council doesn't do your social care provision. It's Kent County Council that does that. But if you look up Tunbridge Wells on the Oflog social care data dashboard, you will see Tunbridge Wells' performance on adult social care, even though it's actually not, it's not that council that is doing it, it's Kent County Council. So I think there's some concern that residents could be misled or misinformed about, okay, you know, that's the wrong council to go to if they have concerns about adult social care. So it is a complex picture. I hope I've explained it okay. But yeah, I think, you know, it's a really interesting, it's an interesting time and an interesting thing to be looking into. But I think that the sector's kind of like, if we're going to do this, we need to do it right. So yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think in response to your story, sort of people sort of noting, you know, there's been no real regulation or oversight of councils' arrangements and for adult social care, because in most cases, a lot of that is kind of, the provision is actually outsourced, or, you know, and councils commission it. And then now we've got two new oversight and assurance regimes, Oflog and the CQC. And I think one bit of an aside, but James Bullion, who is now the CQC Chief Inspector of Social Care, and he was previously Director of Adults at Norfolk County Council, in that previous role, kind of questioned the value of the CQC regime on the basis that, I think he said something like, they believe in it for people, for service users, but it risks being an incredibly expensive way of finding out what we already know, i.e. that social care services are massively struggling after 13 years of funding restraint coupled with growing demand. So I'm kind of not really sure why the government wants to start looking at this, but that's where we are, so we will see.
Well, and I think, you know, sort of almost simultaneously with us publishing my article about Oflog, the government released its framework for the new powers which have been given to the Health and Social Care Secretary to intervene in councils where that have been deemed to be failing on their duties under the Care Act. And I think what was quite interesting in that, I read through the guidance and did a story on it this morning, was that Oflog actually isn't mentioned in there, which I think kind of speaks to something which people were sort of telling me when I was talking to them for my Oflog piece, which is how much of a buy-in has there been from other government departments on Offlog's role. I think if, you know, we've got this work from the Department for Health and Social Care on regulating adult social care, and yet DLUHC has literally unveiled this shiny new data tool, and it's not mentioned at all in this new guide, you know, where's the join up there? There surely there needs to be some.
Yeah, it's not a good advert for integration, is it?
Not at all, not at all. And on a similar theme of, I guess, partnerships and people working together, let's move to the sort of economic sphere. Local enterprise partnerships, or LEPs, as they're sort of known in the jargon, they're these business-led bodies responsible for local economic development, led by business, but also local authorities and other local partners on them. And they're a big deal. About, what, £12 billion of public money has gone to them in their first 9 years or so. The government's just said it's going to stop funding them and it's going to transfer their responsibilities to local government. So combined authorities where they exist, or upper tier councils where there aren't any combined authorities. And I've been having a chat with Jonathan Werren, the chief executive of the Localis think tank, about what this means for the future of local economic development in England. So I'm delighted to be joined by Jonathan Werren, the chief executive of the think tank Localis, to have a bit more of a discussion about LEPs, their legacy, and what is coming next. Now, Jonathan, I know you've done a fair bit of work on LEPs at mm-hmm. Localis. The government is effectively defunding them, transferring their responsibilities. It sounds like they've been a bit of a failure. What's your take on that?
Well, who's to judge what failure is? I think they weren't set up to succeed as well as they could have done. They were creatures of the coalition government. We've got to go back to 2010. John Prescott's regional development agency network was abolished as one of the first acts of Eric Pickles. It was a coalition government. Vince Cable was the business secretary. He didn't believe there should be a business department. Eric Pickles didn't believe that that you should have regional growth boards. So we had this sort of strange love child, local enterprise partnerships set on different geographies with different aims, initially to attract funding for local areas for particular initiatives to help us get out of the after effects of the 2008 financial crisis. I would argue that then you had Lord Heseltine. Lord Heseltine was the coalition growth guru. He championed them in his famous report from 2012, I think, No Stone Unturned. And they were the only game in town. And it continued that way through the coalition years until we had an industrial strategy with Greg Clark. Greg Clark, as business secretary, was a champion of them. They had their detractors in Whitehall. But ultimately, here we are, 2023, they're finally, the experiment has ended. And what I say to you, Martin, it's not the first time in post-war history we've been there. Macmillan's new economic development groups, they ended. The regional development agencies with John Prescott died. We've gone through a alphabet soup of acronym-led growth boards at national level, which have been brought into existence, come to an end, and something new has come in their place.
I mean, that's really interesting, that wider sort of longer context. Now, I know since LEPs have been in existence, I mean, that critics have talked about things like lack of democratic accountability. I know the Public Accounts Committee talked about no real measurement of how they were spending public money. There's been talk about overlap with what councils do on things like skills or infrastructure. Those criticisms, do you think they're overplayed by the critics, or do you think that those are genuine points about how LEPs have done their jobs?
Well, I think it goes back to their origin story. They were under-resourced to begin with. They were, some areas were given local enterprise partnerships, LEPs, that fitted their local political economy and geography. Others were far too big, far too encumbering, and just papering over over large geographic cracks. So yes, it's probably fair to say they some were better than others. The merits of the best could not mitigate some of the failures of the worst. But I would say that during the pandemic years, those local enterprise partnerships that had built up strong local industrial strategies with their local government partners had generally oven ready economic solutions for a country in peril, and you could see the benefit of them. You could have seen them working, but clearly their perceived deficits in democratic accountability and their geographic unevenness was always going to play against them. So it's amazing they survived as long as they did in hindsight.
Because I mean that their demise has been sort of predicted more than once in recent years, I think.
It has been, but even then, talking during the Levelling Up white paper, I was talking to a senior sort of Whitehall official working on that, and he said to me, look, if we didn't have local enterprise partnerships, we'd probably have to invent something that looked, sounded and cracked pretty much like them. There is a need for growth boards at place, and there is a need for an independent voice for business that plugs in at the regional, sub-regional level to get its voice heard.
I think that's a good point to then sort of talk about what comes next. So we know the government's cutting government funding for LEPs. We know the responsibilities are going to upper tier councils or combined authorities when they exist. Do you think that model will succeed, or is that sort of independent voice of local business that you talked about there going to be lost, or we'll see business people not wanting to give their time as they have or engage in this if it's no longer sort of their independent voice in this?
I think that's a very, very, very real risk we run, Martin. So that businesses have a hard enough time in a global economic race, fighting inflation, cost of living, all the energy issues and all the rest of it. If I was business, I'd feel pretty narked that you've been sort of endlessly marched up to the top of a hill and marched down again. Look at the Oxcam arc, all the time and effort that went into engaging with businesses who generally wanted a lead from local, regional and national government as how they could contribute to strategic regional and national prosperity, and that suddenly dies on a whim. Unless business is able to articulate its concerns over skills, infrastructure and the resources it needs to continue to serve as a key local economic anchor in our places, We run the risk of losing that interest. And if we lose that interest from business, what becomes of the LEP assets, their staff, their resources, their knowledge base, will become redundant without the firm interest and active voice and concern of business at the level of place.
Now, you talked about the assets there. Clearly there's a government guidance of people have debated its merit about how the transfer of the assets goes. Any lessons we can learn from when the regional development agencies of New Labour, when they were abolished and there were transfers of assets then? I mean, are there things we can look back and say, okay, don't do that, do that, learn from what's gone on before?
Yeah, I'd argue please assess what the assets are, assess their value, make sure they're not frittered away, and that they are transferred speedily and effectively where they're needed to help kickstart local economic development.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. Now, I wondered, what's the international context for this? Because, I've heard you talk and write before about how other countries manage to do this. How do we compare when it comes to this, government and business working together, local economic strategies working together on skills and so on?
We chop and change far too readily. It's not just beyond political cycles, it's within political cycles. Now, within the last 13 years, we've had the abolition of regional development agencies, creation of LETs, an industrial strategy, a non-industrial strategy. Where do we stand now? Well, if I was a big business, I'd be very confused. In comparison, you think about the post-war settlement we gave to West Germany, in which the land of the federal system, you had business and municipalities working in lockstep for skills, infrastructure to boost economic development, to help drive the post-war German economic wonder years. And they've stuck with that more or less. The besetting sin of post-war Britain is nothing is ever given the chance to work long enough. Everything is a bizarre social experiment between business, local government, central government, which always ends at political cycle or within it. We got to, I think, agree on the consensus. What is a strong national, regional, local programme for growth? Stick with it and see it through to the end.
So, Sarah, that's what Jonathan had to say, a bit of the history there and sort of looking forward into the future and probably a few concerns there from Jonathan. You actually wrote a briefing about this the other day for LGC. The Pitfalls of Pendulum Politics was the lovely alliterative title. What do you make of all this? I mean, is there a risk that the voice of business is going to be lost now when councils, you know, take over these responsibilities?
Yeah, so I think there could be in some places. I think what the point I was sort of making with Pendulum Politics was, you know, as Jonathan was outlining, you had the RDAs, very much sort of public sector body, and then we've gone to something more private sector led with LEPs, and now it, you know, it's almost kind of for the next government to sort of sort out what happens next. From what DLUHC have been saying in their guidance around this, it very much feels like, you know, they've said every area should have a devolution deal by 2030. And once an area has a devolution deal, that combined authority or county will then have the LEP functions. That kind of makes sense, I think. You know, most combined authorities have already taken on those functions anyway. They've also combined them with additional sort of powers or focus on things like attracting inward investment and, you know, sort of the whole package for economic development in an area. What's a bit messier is what happens everywhere else, and particularly in two-tier areas. And we've seen this week the districts come out quite strongly and quite aggrieved at being sort of sidelined in this process of what happens next. So, you know, they argue that as the planning authorities, you know, how can they not be included in sort of plans for economic development in their area? The government, meanwhile, seems really keen to continue this operating these functions over what they call a functional economic area. So that might be more than just one county council, might be a number of councils where, you know, the people that live there would kind of consider it part of the same place. You know, there's a lot of commuting to and from work within that area, and so that seems sort of the footprint that the government really wants this to operate on. But yeah, as I said, the districts are not happy about that.
A classic two-tier row in local government, which happens a lot, but obviously really does matter. I guess the other point you're saying there is, well, the other thing to put in the equation is there could be a new government in 12 months, 18 months. That new government could have different thoughts on this, different thoughts on devolution even. So if we're putting in place sort of architecture in areas without devolution deals in anticipation of them, well, the new government might have a different idea of devolution anyway. So there's probably a lot more pendulum swinging to go on in this sphere of policy.
Yeah, I think we haven't really seen detail from Labour, if they were to form the next government, about what they would do on this. They obviously made lots of very encouraging noises about devolution, but I think, as we've probably said before on the podcast, and certainly on LGC, you know, we're still lacking a bit of detail on what that would actually look like.
Absolutely. So more to press Labour on as and when we talk to them. I think that wraps things up. Thanks everybody for listening. Please do keep an eye on our news stories at lgcplus.com. Do subscribe to this podcast, comment on it, recommend it to your friends, and do look out for our other LGC podcast, The Local Authority, where we have a slightly longer form look into some of the big issues facing the sector.